A written transcript of this episode is provided by Starburst. For more information, you can see the show notes.
Welcome to Data Mesh Radio with your host, Scott Hurlman, sponsored by Starburst. This is Adrian Estala, VP of Data Mesh Consulting Services at Starburst and host of Data Mesh TV. Starburst is the leading sponsor for Trino, the open source project, and Jamak's Data Mesh book, delivering data-driven value at scale. To claim your free book, head over to starburst.io.
Data Mesh Radio, a part of the Data as a Product podcast network, is a free community resource provided by DataStax. Data Mesh Radio is produced and hosted by Scott Hurlman, the co-founder of the Data Mesh Learning Community. This podcast is designed to help you get up to speed on a number of data mesh-related topics. Hopefully, you find it useful. Bottom line up front, what are you going to hear about and learn about in this episode? I interviewed Andrew Padilla, who runs a data and software consulting company, DataSecchia, and also serves as the editor of the Data Mesh Learning Community newsletter. This one is a bit more philosophical about sharing information slash knowledge, so it's one to sit and think over. Things in quotes are direct from Andrew. Some key takeaways slash thoughts that come from Andrew's view of data mesh and the data space in general. Number one, to move from sharing the ones and zeros of data to actually sharing knowledge, we need to harmonize data, metadata, and code. He called this, quote unquote, the digital embodiment of knowledge. That's where Andrew hopes the mesh data products can head, is embodying that knowledge. Number two, software development isn't cutting it for sharing actual knowledge. Will data product development? Not sure. Do we need to move to a knowledge-centered development instead? This remains to be seen. Number three, we still don't know how to model well in data what is going on in the real world. What are the experiences of the organization? Can we really define a quote-unquote organizational experience? Event storming tries but seems to fall short quite often. Number four, we must learn to treat organizations like living entities. Organizational experiences cross multiple domains, and the types of experiences will change. They'll evolve, possibly quite quickly. We have to get better at modeling those experiences and evolving how we share knowledge about those experiences. Number five, knowledge graphs are the best way we currently have for combining information across domains. We still haven't fully figured out how to leverage our cross-domain knowledge, though. Number six, historically, we've bent our ways of working to the limitations of the machines. We need to spend more time on bending the machines to better match the way humans store, process, and share knowledge. Number seven, data centricity is an interesting concept, but might take our current imbalance of data versus operational focus over towards data. That might be what is necessary to really get to a balance and really start to head in the right direction. It remains to be seen. But it's crucial to understand a data-first focus isn't necessarily a knowledge-first or a knowledge as a first-class citizen approach. So just shifting over towards the kind of data centricity, the data first, doesn't mean that we're really going to be sharing that knowledge. Number eight, it's important to understand that mesh data products are a means to an end in data mesh. Yes, they are crucial to sharing information, but they are there to serve a purpose, not that they are the purpose. Finally, number nine, in data mesh, it can be easy to focus too much on creating data products of immediate utility or that are high value in and of themselves. But it's important to think about how data products together create value, and maybe not immediate value, to really drive forward our understanding of the organization's knowledge and experience. If we're overly focused on very, very immediate results, it might mean that we really miss out on the kind of bigger picture because we're too focused myopically on the small picture. So this one's probably going to leave you with more questions than answers, but I think it's an interesting way of looking at the world. With that bottom line up front done, let's jump into the interview. Okay, very, very excited for today's episode. I've got Andrew Padilla here, and he's kind of one of the OG community members of the Data Mesh learning community. He's been in there, I think, since day one. Andrew also has his own consulting company, Data Secchia, and he's also been the editor of the Data Mesh learning newsletter for months and months, almost, I think it's been like 8-9 months since you took over. And so he's been doing really, really great work there. What we're going to talk about today, it's probably going to be a bit of a free-ranging conversation, but we're going to start at least from the idea of like, what data product is what most people talk about it, but why we should maybe even think about calling it the data quantum just to really differentiate it and what that means and how it's really the key to understanding how we actually should be doing data mesh right. So it can be a very, very free-ranging conversation. Before we jump into that, Andrew, if you could give people a bit of an introduction to yourself and your background, and then we can kind of jump into the conversation at hand.
Hey, Scott. Thanks for having me. Going to enjoy this conversation, I'm sure. For everyone who doesn't know me, my name is Andrew Padilla. I own a company called Data Secchia that specializes in data management concerns. My background historically has been in data integration, primarily in the healthcare domain, although I branched out over recent years, and or other software products that focus on data management concerns. So that's where my lens is going to be focused from probably today.
Yeah. And so we were looking at talking about kind of what is the data quantum and why it's key. Why don't we start with a little bit about your viewpoint on this and kind of what makes it such a crucial aspect to nail? Because so many people are having difficulty defining what should be their data product or data quantum or whatever. Like, how do you define that, like from a technology standpoint or, you know, technical bent? And how do you define it for the business people so they understand? If you start to talk APIs with the business people, you've already lost. So I agree with you that it's very, very crucial. But like, why don't you give people a bit of your kind of view on this and why it's so important to get right?
Sure. So to start off, I think that, you know, the data product components, as it's described by Zhamak, is right on the money. And I've noticed that in my own experience that, you know, oftentimes if you're in software development, as you're going through projects, you notice that there is a disconnect between, you know, the data that you're using, the metadata that describes it, and your software code in the development lifecycle, when you're deploying, et cetera. It kind of begs for something more. And I think a lot of people have come to that conclusion, and probably whether they've said it or not, have understood that these sorts of things have an affinity to one another and they belong together. And I think that's when you really come to think, well, is this a higher level abstraction that needs to be, you know, put together as one? And I think that's exactly what Zhamak was describing when she described a data product as the architectural quantum, something that's indivisible and needs to be thought of at that level so that you can do the interesting things that we would like to do with data. And today, although this is changing slowly, we're starting to think of it in that way.
And you talked about kind of it's the harmony between the data, metadata, and the code, but that it's not really, we haven't figured out how to actually hit those harmonies, right? That we've got just kind of different discordant sounds that aren't really meshing well together. So like, how do you think that we start to move towards that? And Jamak is kind of a coloring to this, is Jamak is kind of frustrated by the concept of data and metadata, because it's the information. The data and metadata together is the information, and you can't really separate the two, or what's the layering between those. So I think she's fully in agreement with what you're saying, but like, how have you started to see people move towards that, or how do you think we can move towards that?
Yeah, good question. I think that at some point we have to perhaps even lose the distinction between software development and data product development, as folks are starting to think about it now, and think more towards knowledge development. Because in my mind, the kind of the digital embodiment of human knowledge that we've been building so far, although it's been somewhat disjointed, are these three components: data and metadata and code, which is essentially the behavior around the data and metadata, that interaction. So I think, and probably the folks in the knowledge graph camp would probably agree, that we're talking about knowledge development, and that is the new kind of minimum bar, or how we start to think about the experiences that happen inside the organization, and how do we capture those, and how do we leverage those dynamically, much in the same way that people, and I love to use the biological kind of tie-ins. How do people develop ideas or share their experiences? We don't talk in terms of synapses or neurons. We talk in terms of what happened yesterday and what the experience was and what you thought of it. And so I think what we're seeing here is the very beginning of seeing what we're building in the electronic world or the virtual world is something that is kind of the electronic embodiment of knowledge. And that is the data product as we describe it today. This is the first stage of that. Sounds far out, but I do think we're going there.
Yeah. And when you talk about that experience, I want to understand something, because you talked about the internal experience. Do you mean, or the experience for the organization, I think is how you said it. Do you mean that that's specifically only internal facing, or that, I mean, I do think that we've kind of moved much more towards the external experience when we think about software as well. When we think about customers, and that it's, UX and all that is so crucial to it. So do you think it's all tied into one, or do you kind of look to separate the experience to those internal to the organization and those external to the organization? Just because I think one thing that I'm struggling with Data Mesh a little bit is there's so much context already in people's heads that if we're trying to add so much more, I mean, could this simplify that context? Could it complicate it? It's such a, like you said, it's a little bit far out there from where we are right now, but I don't think it's far out there when you actually think about what are we trying to accomplish from a high level.
No, and I would agree. I mean, I think it's clear. I think it becomes crystal clear when you start thinking about, this is all about modeling what people do in the real world, right? So we're not confined to, the conversations and or the interactions we have in the organizations. And in fact, domains are attempting to model, the places in which we have these interactions and learn and have a certain perspective. So likewise, I don't know that there's any kind of boundaries or limitations to, whether or not the knowledge is acquired internally or externally, but certainly there are boundaries in terms of how you think about things, in the same way that people, may have conversations at a given place. And so place has, defines context. And so we learn things from a certain perspective in one interaction. And then if we are among another group of people or in another place, the context defines the learnings that we take from there. In the end, we kind of put them all together and come up to our own opinions. I mean, that's the insider knowledge that we're attempting to emulate here in a digital commons, so to speak. But I do think in the end, we will have, you know, it should be unbounded in that sense. And I think that's where we're going. I always thought that data mesh was most perfectly suited for inter or cross organizational purposes, because they have those kinds of pain points that it describes. And internally, often you can get around these up to a point by, you know, just having this kind of, you know, tribal knowledge and just being able to push through the issues about gaps in knowledge that are in the system. People can kind of get through those internally until it gets so large that it's impossible to move forward without extracting that from the people who have that expertise.
Yeah, I kind of think of it, for some reason it just popped into my head, but that when what we've done historically is built kind of these one-to-one threads, and when you think about those threads all crossing throughout the organization, it's not that bad until it is, because you've just got all these kind of threads that are all now, you know, going all past each other, and you just create this big knot and trying to push another thread through, or trying to, extract a single thread to figure out what's going on and follow that one thread. I don't know if you've ever had that kind of balled up headphones or anything in your pocket where you're trying to untangle all of that, and how fun that can be. But I think data mesh is not, it's one of those things where there are some people out there saying, well, everybody should do data mesh, and you know, there's a cost to decentralization and things like that. And I think a lot of people can learn from this, but I do think it's not until you really run across these challenges that, like you said, you can kind of push forward and push through. Cost benefit, is there really a reason to do this just for the sake of doing it? You might have a higher return, but your investments in your data capabilities are going to be so much higher. So I think it's a little bit of buyer beware. I think you and I have shared that with each other quite a bit.
Yeah, definitely agree. I do think, to be clear, that data mesh is for organizations that have larger data teams and are experiencing those pain points, then it starts to make sense. I don't think in life there is any single silver bullet solution that is agnostic to the context in which you apply it. And this is definitely the case here. If you even look at, you know, people refer to startups as being very nimble and agile because they can just, you know, talk to each other. They're all in the same room possibly, and they have that because of the environment that they're in. But of course, they experience pain points and they start to emulate what their larger organizational brothers start to look like, you know, as they get larger. And I've experienced that being part of a small startup and then moving on to, you know, Fortune 500 employer. You can see the differences there, and the culture is there for a reason, and the way they interact is there for a reason. And that's just a product of growth.
Yeah. And I'd like to circle back on the stuff that you were talking about as well, of this sharing experiences. For myself, I haven't seen anybody that's doing this very well, right? So it can feel pretty theoretical. Do you have any kind of advice or approach or information that you'd kind of tell somebody let's say they go, Andrew, I'm 100% in line with everything you just said. Like, where do I go next? Like, what do I learn about this? Is it the knowledge graph stuff? Is it the Dave McComb type of, I can't even think of the phrasing right now, but
data centricity.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So like, where would you tell people to kind of look first or to start to poke at and see, is this just a framing on a problem that we've known exists and that we can think of it from a new approach, because that's an easier way to move forward than do I have to completely reframe my entire world?
Yeah. So I'm not necessarily sure that I have advice for people. I'm kind of evolving this point of view of thinking about the knowledge in an organization as experience. But yeah, I'm not sure I can push anybody to like a certain direction, but I think it's a good thought experiment, because what we're trying to do here is model, again, the everyday world and those interactions. And so if you think about experience on a human level and apply it to an organization, you know, organizations in some ways, in a legal sense, are living entities. And where data and software and metadata, where they all come in, is they are kind of, if you think of it this way, they're kind of the embodiment of the organizational experience. And so, you know, how do you effectively curate that so that, you know, you're making the most of that? We do it every day without even thinking about it. We experience different places, talk to different people, et cetera. In the end, we come to our own conclusions about you know, decisions that we make. But I think at the very least, it's a useful thought experiment to say, what does it mean for an organization to have experience, and what are we trying to do with it? Well, certainly knowledge is the acquisition of experiences, right? And so I think it does kind of overlay well to what we're starting to see in data mesh. And if we kind of think in this way, it may set a path for where we want to go. We're building kind of like this meta-human entity, in a sense, for the organization. I'll leave it at that.
Well, I think it ties into some of the conversations of past episodes around domain-driven design, about the concept of event storming. So the organization has an experience. You know, it's not event as in event streaming and things like that, but there is something that has happened. And how do we represent that? How do we abstract that into such a way that other people can consume it, and that we can somewhat standardize what happened with that experience, just so that it's not that every single experience is in and of itself. I've kind of talked about this with, you know, what Jamak has talked about with the experience plane and data mesh of, if every single data quantum is a completely new user experience, that's going to be an awful user experience for somebody trying to consume, because you have to learn entirely new ways of accessing this information each time you go to from a different source. So, like, how do we think about what the abstraction or the way to actually model that maximizes the context? And then kind of what we've talked about privately as well, of how do we evolve the concept of these experiences? Because it might be that this was kind of the standard experience, you know, 6 months ago. Obviously, Vasylum talked about on his episode of their concept of an order is kind of 10x larger in scale, because it's so different than it was 3-4 years ago. So, like, how do we think about that evolution, and how do we think about actually translating those experiences into information or knowledge or things like that? What have you seen there that's useful for people to start to kind of poke at?
So, you know, the experiences that we have as people, they never live on an island. So it would be very foreign for a person to have experiences in isolation. And so what is different about that versus a very real reality in organizations today, where we have these silos, where there's no connection between the experiences of one domain and another? And the difference is that, you know, we're constantly tying together as we experience things, other things that occur there that have occurred in our lives, and tying together this sort of mapping that makes sense to us. And it's a continual process. So we look at that as kind of a reference or a model. I think that there should be some way that as we're building out something that adheres to data mesh principles, that we are constantly, as we say, trying to make sense of or map the knowledge that we're getting from the different areas in the organization as we move forward. And that's as important as collecting it. Definitely establishing links from one domain to the next as that kind of life cycle makes the most sense to me. I don't know in practice how folks are doing that today. If this is kind of thought of after a domain product is being built, for those that are actually out there in the wild implementing data mesh architectures. But that's how I think of it.
Yeah, I think it makes sense. And I think so much of the conversations around data mesh and data specifically, kind of more generally, but very, you know, it's that we get way too much into the how do I do this? How do I do this? How do I do this? Instead of like, what are we trying to accomplish? And a lot of what you're talking about is that like, we're trying to accomplish an understanding and an ability to connect the understandings of what is occurring, you know, as you're talking about the organizational experience from this domain and this domain, that they aren't in a vacuum, right? Like it's not, especially when you think about like the customer domain, that's not, we have it as a domain just so that we have a bounded context around it, that we don't have to think about the entire organization in every way at all points. So I think what people have started to talk about is that they're using knowledge graphs to show people that there are connections. But I think exactly what you're talking about, we need to have the way that we can manifest those connections for people to actually leverage them when we've discovered them and we want to share them. I know you're a big fan of knowledge graphs and things like that. How do you see knowledge graphs starting to play into this, or where do you think knowledge graphs should play, whether it's what people are doing or not?
Yeah, so I am a big fan of knowledge graphs. And from the very beginning, even though I was pretty new to knowledge graphs, I really bought into the concept behind them. And within the context of data mesh, I really see knowledge graphs as the glue to the domains, providing those connections as you're curating domain-specific knowledge, that you are also making those connections. Like, we seamlessly do that. And I keep going back to like this human reference to how we, you know, gather knowledge and make sense of it, how we get to understanding. And that's really the goal. But we're constantly cross-referencing, you know, the things we do in different places and how it relates to what we're doing now. And if you think of that in terms of domains, these are all just, you know, time and place scenarios that we acquire experiences. And so where knowledge graphs could play a pivotal role here is being able to provide those linkages or tie-ins as an integral process of not only developing and offering the domain knowledge from a particular organizational unit, let's say, to other ones, such that It is seamless for you to be able to provide those linkages from other domains as you move along. And I know that's the goal, but I think it's part and parcel of actually even just curating the data within the domain, that you have this easy access to it. And going back to, you know, how we do things as people, you know, when I'm thinking about a topic, you and I are having a conversation, in the back of my mind, I'm thinking about another conversation that is related, right? And relationships is what knowledge graphs is all about. and I'm making sense of it as I'm developing my own thoughts on it, or, you know, taking your thoughts and just, you know, accepting them or rejecting them or whatever the case may be. I'm doing that as part of that kind of curation process. So what would it take for us to do that in technology, in the data world? It means that as we are curating domain-specific knowledge, that we have complete unfettered access to other knowledge in the domain as we're you know, acquiring this knowledge. So if something comes in on, you know, some piece of data comes in on a given domain, we were able to make that connection to a relationship somewhere else. Now, is this technologically commonplace or feasible now? I don't think so. Is it possible? I certainly do think so. I think that it is possible. But the first thing that we need to do is think about, you know, what we naturally do as people, because we're in the end, we always end up making things that are kind of images of how we do things, right? That almost sounds biblical, but I don't mean it in that sense. But we tend to do things. We operate in a certain way. So we want to look for a model as to how we want to move forward technology. We just look no further than the interactions we have. And in a sense, I think we started to do that. But just dig deeper into how we gain insights. And we're constantly making connections, even as we're acquiring knowledge in a certain time and place.
I had almost a petulant thought here, which is, so when we talk about Conway's Law, it's about how the organization, you know, it's tied into how the organization communicates and works and things together, right? Is there a higher law of we need to adapt our systems to really work in the way that humans in general work with information themselves, right? Because I don't think we've focused as much on we were talking about the organizational experience, but the human experience of bringing in those past bits of information and conversation, and that, you know, okay, should I be changing my opinion? Am I adding new information? Should I be rejecting this information? It's not something that I've seen really people talk about pushing into their systems, that they want, because it's the way that we already experience the world. So are we trying to get humans to completely change the way that they experience the world so that they can leverage what we've created from our knowledge sharing, our data sharing practices? Or do we want to move as much as we can towards, like, what is the already human experience, and that we just kind of try and mirror it from how we do knowledge and data sharing and things like that? You know, like I said, I think it's a little bit of a petulant thought, but at the same point, I don't know. What are your reactions to that?
Yeah, well, I would completely agree. I think that is the next step. And whether we think we're doing that or not now with how we're thinking about data mesh, I think it's a step in that direction. I think what we've done in the past since kind of the beginning of computing is that we've had to deal with the limitations of the technology, and so we've become conditioned in a sense to be able to operate in the way that the technology could operate, that it had limitations in the way it does things. And I think if you look hard at the past 20 or 30 years, we're really bending to the limitations of the technology. For instance, why do we have centralized architectures? Well, because 30, 40 years ago, that was the only way that we could really do that. To put out a decentralized architecture would have been unheard of. It would have been unthought of. So we've been somewhat conditioned by the machines. But now I think we're coming to a place where we can start saying, well, we have the technology to start making the machines bend to our way of doing things, or at least the way we perceive that we do things. And I think that opens up a lot of possibilities.
Yeah, I think it's just something that's so, to me, I'm very much a kind of, I don't want to say practical versus impractical, but I'm like, okay, I think about what is the art of the possible, but within the bounds. And like, we need bigger thinkers to think outside of the bounds, which I think is part of why data mesh has upset a lot of people, is that it's like, well, these are outside of the bounds. So it's not going to work, right? Because it's not what we've done before. So, but yeah, I think it, what an interesting tie into this conversation might be to pop to even a very high level and say, like, what was it from within data mesh that kind of caught your eye when you're thinking about your background and your experience of looking at how we actually experience the world? I think there's a lot of tie-ins that we've had in kind of private conversations about, like, what was it that made you, was it just that it's thinking differently and that it's trying to shake things up and that it might be, or was there any specific thing that really kind of caught your eye to it? Or
yeah, well, certainly anything that is new and different catches my attention. Whether or not it keeps my attention is another matter. But in this particular case, you know, and many people have said this, I've thought about some of the concepts that Zhamak laid out in the first two articles prior to reading the articles, and that's what brought my attention to them. I will say that, you know, my thoughts weren't as cohesive or as nearly as articulated as hers, but it did ring a bell to me, because I've seen, you know, in my own experience in doing, you know, data integration or software that deals with data integration, that there's always been a disconnect between, you know, application software and, you know, the data that it produces. They were almost, you know, two separate, you know, well, two distinct islands, so to speak, and that really they belonged together. And I think that was the biggest thing, that the data, metadata, and logic or code, as it's described, really belong together before you can start to do interesting things. And this was the first nod that I had ever seen outside of my own thoughts to that, which is described now as a data product. And so that was really the big interest for me. And I'm also interested in those that promote, you know, data more as a first class citizen, although I do think there are limits to that. So for instance, Dave McComb, promotes data centricity. And I believe we had a conversation one time where I mentioned, you know, isn't that swinging the pendulum too far the other way? And he said, you know, perhaps, but because we want to get the attention of folks in the industry, that we're not paying enough attention to the data problem. We're not giving it the first class citizenry that it deserves, that this is a way to do that. But I do think somewhere in the middle, and maybe this is just me being a centrist, somewhere in the middle is where the truth lies. And that is that these components are all bundled together. And that's the basis from which we should start working. We're not a data engineer, necessarily a software engineer. We are dealing with knowledge. And I know there's a term, knowledge engineer, and I'm not sure I'm attributing what I'm thinking to what they're thinking. But I do think that's where we're headed, that, you know, the pendulum is not swinging too far to the right or too far to the left, that we're dealing with things as we as humans deal with them. And that is the basis for building, you know, the next generation technology.
And I think the non-tightly coupled nature of the data products is really crucial. But as people have said, you know, if we don't figure out how to do the integration well, then data integration is all the time, you know, that's where we spend most of our effort on. And so we have to figure out how to get there. But I do think that it's better to, in a lot of instances, to start at least with the high quality data and that it really represents what it's trying to represent, and that we can figure out how to do integrations. You know, Samia Raman on her episode talked about, well, we can kind of evolve where we don't need all data to interoperate with all other data, right? It's fine to have certain things that that interoperate when we need them to, and that we can evolve those, but we haven't had this evolutionary concept around data. It's been, and part of that's been the technology, I think, right? You and I kind of talked about this as well, of with a data warehouse, with an enterprise data warehouse, not with data warehousing, which is the fun of language. there's a difference between those, but you kind of have to get everything pretty right at the start, right? And it's starting to already have issues even before you deploy it, because you spent so much time threading all these needles, and then the needles are already starting to move and all of that. But we haven't really had something that works where we haven't had that tight coupling, or we haven't had that really strict limitations. So, I mean, if you were talking to somebody that was feeling the pain of working in a completely different way and in a new world, like how would you talk to them to get them over to your way of thinking? Like, how would you give them the gentle, you know, go and take them by the hand instead of shove or tug?
Yeah, good question. I think the data mesh is going to take some time, and the underlying concepts behind it, they'll probably evolve over the next few years for sure. Not to say that the core concepts are not solid, but I do think that in coming to an understanding and bringing more people on board, that you know, it's inevitable that it will evolve. But if I'm trying to bring somebody on board to thinking in this way, I would... Yeah, it's a difficult prospect, because you know I kind of accepted these concepts early on, because it was a product of my own frustrations, but not everybody probably perceives it in that way. Maybe they're just fine with the way things are. But I guess I would speak to their frustrations first, and then attempt to paint a picture as to, if things were thought of in a different way, where there is this tight coupling between, you know, data, metadata, and code, you know, how that might resolve some of their frustrations, and then let them run with that. I think it's always important for those you're trying to convey a concept to, for them to take ownership. So start there, plant the seed based on frustrations, and then let them kind of take it from there. And if you're successful in that, then, you know, there's not a lot of convincing that you have to do after that. They take ownership of it, and starts with, you know, pain points, in much the same way that people are articulating why products are so great, because if they address pain points, people like them, right?
And I think that's another conversation that I want to jump down, is kind of the product concept and kind of how we actually apply product thinking and how that could go wrong within data. But one point that you had made to me previously that I think is really important when people are thinking about how they would create a data quantum is, you were talking about how you think data is pretty flat, that it's 2D, and you know, how do we get to 3D, and maybe even, you know, talking about 4D or whatever. Like, how would you kind of characterize that, or how would you explain what you mean by data has been kind of flat, it's been 2D, and then where we need to go with that?
Sure. So that was a good conversation, I never thought of it that way. You know, you hear people in physics use that analogy of the 2D man, you know, that the world that he lives in. But I think it's very applicable here, because people are either on one side of this swinging pendulum or another, and they're thinking in inadequate dimensions. And so if you think about the 2D man, and let's just take a use case for the 2D man, you know, there's a line drawn in front of him, and he only thinks in terms of data, or only thinks in terms of code, one or the other. He has a barrier to cross. He wants to get to the other side. He doesn't think to walk over the barrier, because he's a two-dimensional being. He has to go around it. and it may be a very long line, and hence the problem. But he doesn't see what's obvious to those of us who live in the three-dimensional world. And so I think that's how I see the frustrations of people who are very, you know, held to, you know, one side of the fence or the other, and they're not seeing the bigger picture, which is the reality of it, right? And so the more dimensions that you add to your thought process, the simpler the problem sets become, because you can see, you know, from, well, multiple dimensions. So if you add 3D, it becomes simpler. If you add 4D, which is, if you go back to physics, that would be time, it's a simpler proposition as well. So just thinking about those and thinking about the 2D man and how that applies to the way we've been thinking about things, I think is a helpful exercise to begin with. And I didn't, that didn't occur to me until we started having that conversation. But then, you know, again, when we had the conversation, I was drawing, I don't remember the exact context, but I was drawing a reference to something else I had learned that I thought was completely different, but it was actually completely relevant. So see, these are the connections that you make to start gaining insight as people, right? This is what we want our technology to help us do, not do for us, but help us do, right? So I'm still a fan of people, process, and technology. It's all, again, that's another quantum, right? If you think about that. So there needs to be some kind of symbiosis or the like in that.
Yeah, well, and I think the episode that we were, that was talking about kind of 4D objects or hyper objects was João Rosa. And I think you and I had both just kind of, you had just listened to it. I had recorded it a month prior, but I think that that's a very useful concept because, again, with data, we've tried to lock onto this is what we're going to share, and we're going to keep sharing it until it breaks, even if the real world has changed. Like, what is that organization experiencing? Has that become something different? And how do we represent what's actually going on instead of how do we keep sharing the same report? Like, I want to hang on to this report for the with a death grip because I want it to be this same thing versus, well, shouldn't we be sharing like what's actually happening? The if what you're sharing in data isn't evolving, is your business evolving with the real world? Or like, or you're not sharing, your data isn't there to be data. It's there to share what is actually happening with the organization. What is it experiencing? So I think it's an interesting analogy that you would come up with, and I really liked it. I did want to talk about the concept of the product mindset. We were talking about this a little bit, that there was a post that Juan Cicada and Tim Gasper had talked about, or they'd put out of their data product ABCs. Tim was on the podcast kind of when they were first developing this. So would love to get kind of your feedback on that, and where I think, you know, I posted that data products and data as a product are very, very different, and that we have to think about kind of what you were talking about, that the life cycle generation of information and knowledge, rather than, you know, just thinking about what is the data product, we're trying to share the organizational experience. That's
right.
Embedding product thinking into everything, because it's like, okay, we're doing, we have to really think about not that the data product is the end result or that's what we're trying to get to. It's we're trying to get to sharing that, and we're doing that via product. So you were saying, yes, some really interesting things there, and I want to give you kind of the floor to talk about what your reaction was as well.
Yeah, that's actually a very good way to put it, Scott. I see the data product as a means to an end. And if you look at, you know, Zhemak's data mesh principles and logical architecture, she talks about the data product as a concept, as the architectural quantum, or like this minimum brick or building block in which you want to build your knowledge. And it has the unfortunate I guess, fortunate experience of having the word product in it. And so that's a little bit ambiguous. And I, although I'm not against thinking about data in terms of a product necessarily, especially if you're a data marketplace, you're actually, this is the end product. But oftentimes data, you know, useful knowledge or useful information within an organization is a means to an end and not an end in itself, as you describe. So I think that ambiguity, at least in my mind, can cause folks to think about only the extrinsic value of data and not its intrinsic value to the organization. And I think that's where the fork in the road it has yet to be had with those interested in data mesh. We'll see how it evolves. My interpretation may be entirely wrong, but I tend to think that it is a means to an end and not an end in itself, and that it is not a microcosm business within a business. And although there are many positive attributes of once you start to think of something as a consumer product, there are certain things that you do that you wouldn't do in a project. Those are good things. And I could see the parallels there. But I think you can achieve those things without this thought of monetization, whether that's real or just perceived. And there could be negative consequences to always putting a dollar sticker on things. It could skew, you know, your intended outcomes. So it's just another way to think about it. And it's not clear to me how many other people have been thinking about it. I think Juan probably has mindshare in that respect. I think a lot of people are thinking of in terms of, you know, this is actually a product, whether or not money is exchanging hands within an organization, et cetera. I think many people can relate to that, and probably because it's worked in the software world, but you are selling software. Many people are using it directly to interact with their customer base. That makes sense. With data, that kind of comes after. Again, they're intertwined, but it comes after, and it's not necessarily something that you're offering to the customer in the beginning. It depends, I guess. There's my consulting answer.
and I think that's, you know, I had Jarkko Moilanen on, and he was talking about the three different layers of the data economy, and there's, you know, sharing internally is his base layer, and said that that was the most basic. And I'm like, I just didn't necessarily agree. You know, the second layer was sharing for a specific purpose. So you might have kind of these data clean room type of things where you're exchanging information with other organizations for a very specific use case. And then there was kind of packaging it and selling it. And there's a lot of companies that are heading in this data marketplace concept internally. But I kind of agree with you on, or I actually strongly agree with you, not kind of, that it can create perverse incentives, right? It can create, I want to create the most popular data product, or that's going to be viewed as having the most value, instead of I'm going to put something out there that we're not sure if it has value, right? And if we're not sure it has value, then should we be doing that? And I think when you're in, you know, day one, day 90, day 365 of your data mesh journey, you should probably be looking for those things where you have value. And we don't have a good way of measuring intrinsic value either, which is frustrating. But that we have to really think about, if we're going to move beyond what we've done with data, that we have to be open to, this could be a new source of value for the company that I don't know the explicit dollar exchange kind of monetary.
Yeah, I agree. It putting a dollar sign on it, or even if it's somewhat contrived, forces the issue as to whether or not it has immediate value. And sometimes you don't know. And a good way to think about this is, you know, a company's R&D division, if they have one, they're not putting dollar signs on those. They don't know what the value of the R&D is going to produce. But they incubate it. They see what happens. And so if you don't have that playground, and I'm thinking in terms of data mesh, you may miss out on opportunities if you're forcing the issue as to what kind of value data has. And that's not to say that, you know, to go back to data lakes and just, you know, put it out there and maybe sooner or later it's going to have some value. There has to be some intention about it. But at the same time, again, going to the middle ground, you know, putting a dollar sign on things forces you to think, what's the immediate utility of this? And perhaps there isn't any, but it's still valuable. So, you know, how do you address that?
And there are a couple of companies that have gone down that path. You know, EMD Electronics, Emmanuel Schweizer was talking about, they're just getting in the habit of sharing way, way more data, but it's not in the form of a data product. And then the data products naturally emerge because people start to say, well, we need this with this quality and this. And now that they understand who are the owners and those owners are empowered to actually go and create these data products, that there is this big pool. Justin Cunningham had said that that's what worked for them well in theirs as well. That when he was at, especially when he was at Yelp and somewhat at Netflix, of just sharing a whole bunch of data and not saying, we're going to make it, you know, product level, but we're going to show you what we've got so you can play around with it and say, what might have value? And then you start that negotiation of, okay, we think this has value. What aspect, you know, Emily Gorsinski's episode around SLOs talked about that of like, what's actually valuable about this? Is it that it's super, super timely, or is it that it's super, super accurate, or like what matters and what doesn't, so that we're not saying everything has to hit these, you know, five very difficult to hit SLOs. We can start to relax constraints as to, you know, oh, okay, the accuracy on this is, it's much lower, but the timeliness is much shorter. So it's as things are happening, we get that picture. So I think it's really, it's tough because to get budget to actually do something, people have to see the value. But so I don't know if what we're thinking of is a little bit pie in the sky. Like, wouldn't it be nice? We are seeing people that are having benefits from doing this, but it's, I think we'll see kind of two different camps, and I don't think one is necessarily right or wrong, but I'd love to get kind of your feelings on that as well.
Yeah. I don't think it's one or the other. I think you can implement data mesh principles, and perhaps you only focus on the ones with high immediate utility. If there's pressure to get some value out of it, if your organization is more adventurous and they have the latitude to say, we want to do a little bit of discovery, we want to do a little R&D, then certainly, it, with a potential payoff, then certainly, you know, go in that direction, right? And what does that look like? I mean, that looks like when, you know, when I have certain ideas that I think are a little bit crazy, I don't throw them away necessarily. I keep them in the back of my mind. But as I get more and more connections based on conversations I have with people, things that I read, things that I experience, and as more connections kind of accrue, then to me, the number of connections to that thought starts to accrue value. And I think if I were to think of the value of the data product, it's the number of connections to other things that defines its value. Because that means you're onto something, right?
Yeah, that's I never really developed it, but the Scott's confusing ass equation, the SCAE, was like each data product individually has value, but like when does the incremental value of adding a data product, is it greater in its connections than in and of itself, right? You know, each data product has right. One point of product value, and for each product that it's connected to, it has 0.1 value. So, you know, when you've got two, it's like, okay, those two connect, but each one is one and the interconnection between them is worth 0.1. But when you get 500, and they may not all be interconnected with each other, but, you know, you get 500 of those and those interconnections really start to, it's the, I can't remember, is it combinatorial mathematics? Like the combinations end up being so much higher than the you know, first order of each of the dots, the combinations between the two, the dots end up being so much greater. So I think what you're talking about, maybe when we figure out how to do data products, like the cost of an incremental data product is relatively low, that's when we can really start to turn on the, let's test this out. Let's do the product marketing and figure out like, hey, we created this thing. Is this of use? Like, and that you don't have what we've kind of had with, we're not sure if somebody's consuming it, so we have to keep producing it. If you have the information that nobody's consuming it, you can shut it down. Maybe that's the other aspect of it, is that it's not even just the development costs, but it's the ongoing costs as well, that we have that information flow.
Yeah, I think I agree that data by a product by itself may not have very high utility. And certainly when you pair it with other products, that's when you're going to get the real value. But you don't know what that's going to be yet. And the challenge is, you know, right now at least, we're just not there in terms of being able to dynamically produce products with ease and at low cost. It's an uphill climb, and it's all very new. Many argue that this is not a technology issue, data mesh, but certainly the tooling now is lacking towards this effort in thinking in this way. There are a lot of tools, but not cohesive tools that allow you to put out products in the way that I can put out thoughts and just tuck them away and then wait for something else that relates to it to give it some more value. When we get to a point where we can do those sorts of things, then that life cycle for a data product would be much simpler, and we can focus on things that have potential value. And if they don't work out and, you know, the machinery behind it can determine that it doesn't have value, then you can throw it away. But it does seem like there is an uphill climb in producing the data product now, and that kind of pushes aside potentials. And so you really have to look hard for, you know, what's going to give me the immediate bang for the buck. That's where we are now. But I think in time, we won't be there. We'll be at a place where we can do some exploratory. Or maybe that's pie in the sky. I don't know. But certainly, if we're trying to create the ultimate machine and the machine is us, I think that's where we're going
to
be.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we do end up having to move towards mirroring the way humans understand and think and work. And I mean, it's funny how many different, my brain is kind of overloaded at this point. Like I'm going to go take the dog on a walk and just think. Like I usually listen to a podcast or whatever, and I think I'm just going to think and just let things kind of sink in, because we covered a lot of different stuff, but a lot of it's really making me rethink, or it's narrowed in my thinking on a lot of different things. So this has been really great for me. Is there anything we didn't cover that you wanted to cover, or is there any way you want to kind of wrap up the kind of everything we've covered here?
I'd love to see some feedback on these sorts of thoughts. I'd love to connect with other people that are thinking in this way or have something to add to it. I'm always open to that. So I will put that out there, but I think, we've done enough. We've reached our limits for this conversation, and I'll give you a break.
I do highly recommend, I mean, I've, been chatting with Andrew, kind of in, DMs and stuff for months and months. Let's probably over a year now, right? Like that we've been chatting and everything like that. So I do recommend that people reach out, because this, again, it's, I think you're that person in the community that is a really, really helpful sounding board, and that you play off of people very well for these conversations. So I do recommend people reach out. If people do want to reach out, where's the best place? Is it like just the Slack or LinkedIn, or what's the easiest place to kind of get in touch with you?
LinkedIn would be great. I'm a big user of LinkedIn, or Slack would be fine.
Okay. And from your company standpoint, if people want to reach out, do you have a specialty that you'd want that you think if people are running across specific challenges, that's something that you are helpful on that as well? I want to make sure that people are aware of what the company does.
Sure. Yeah. Generally speaking, DataSecia focuses on data engineering concerns and may be surprising, but I don't necessarily focus on data mesh, although I think that will be changing in the future, simply because my customer base, they're smaller to mid-sized companies, and they don't have those pain points that we spoke about before. But, you know, data engineering concerns, a lot of projects around just helping organize teams. You know, many of the companies I come across, they have the resources, but they just don't have the experience in building, you know, software products or data teams. And that's where they need help. So I guide them through that process. And that's a result of my experience in the spectrum of, you know, a few startups to exit to working at IBM in information management and Watson Health. And so those were different experiences, going back to that again, as I have this whole conversation, but it led me to some conclusions on how teams should be run.
Yeah.
And again, it all depends, but I have some success there.
Well, again, Andrew, thank you so much for spending the time with me today. And thank you, everyone, for listening.
Thanks, Scott. Appreciate it.
I'd again like to thank my guest today, Andrew Padilla, who runs a data and software consulting company, DataSecia, and serves as editor of the Data Mesh Learning Community newsletter. You can find a link to his LinkedIn, his Substack, his company website, and the Data Mesh Learning newsletter Substack in the show notes. Thank you. Thanks, everyone, for listening to another great guest on the Data Mesh Learning podcast. Thanks again to our sponsors, especially DataStax, who actually pays for me full-time to help out the Data Mesh community. If you're looking for a scalable, extremely cost-efficient, multi-data center, multi-cloud database offering and or an easy-to-scale data streaming offering, check DataStax out. There's a link in the show notes. If you want to get in touch with me, there's links in the show notes to go ahead and reach out. I would love to hear more about what you're doing with Data Mesh and how I can be helpful. So please do reach out and let me know, as well as if you'd like to be a guest. Check out the show notes for more information. Thanks so much.